like to migrate bullets on a weekly rather than a monthly cycle. I use weekly logs only when I have a lot on my plate. I'm not wild about rewriting things either, so I only do it when it helps me stay on top of my game. Others find weekly migration useful when they don't have a lot going on, and they can fit a whole week's worth of tasks on a page or two. Again, it always depends on what suits your needs. I like to keep my weekly log simple, so I repurpose the daily log template, except the topic is the week's date range, say June 14th to the 21st. Migrating your mental inventory. To get a taste of migration, you can use the mental inventory that you created earlier to populate your notebook. Before you dive in, review your mental inventory. Make sure everything you listed is worth the time and energy it will take to rewrite it, to filter out the meaningful from the meaningless. Now decide what things you need to work on over the following month. Those items will go into the monthly log's tasks page. Future tasks and events will go into the future log. Related items, like books you want to read, will be organized into their own custom collection. Don't worry about getting everything right or perfect. Every master starts by picking up a tool for the first time. This is just the first step in a process that will continue to evolve as long as you bullet journal. Be patient with yourself, and remember, do what works for you. The letter. Now you may be asking yourself, why would I bother doing all this stuff? It's a fair question. So before we get into the big why behind bullet journaling itself, I want to share a letter from a bullet journalist who requested to remain anonymous that exemplifies just how impactful the system can be when integrated into your life. Organization is only partly about crossing things off our list. It's also about becoming aware of what truly matters. It's a parent's worst nightmare, standing by helplessly as your child struggles to breathe. The EMTs rush into the room with their giant bags and a stretcher, firing off stats and rapid questions to those nearby. The kid turns blue, eyes sliding shut. They start CPR, and you watch as the little body jumps with each push on his chest. This was the scene a week ago in my son's preschool class. His 8 classmates all have health and developmental problems ranging from moderate to severe, and the class exists to help them catch up with their peers. Among the ailments are brain tumors, multiple sclerosis, cystic fibrosis, autism, and cancer in remission. The little boy who stopped breathing had been acting a little funny earlier that day, but was not feverish or sick. Not 5 minutes earlier, he was happy and playing alongside my son at the train table. I looked away to help another kiddo find an orange crayon, and then, all of a sudden, shouting and semi-controlled chaos. Then 911. Then the EMTs. Then the oxygen rushed out of the room, and I think those of us parents and teachers on duty collectively held our breaths as the rest of the children were herded off to neighboring classrooms for safekeeping. The mom on duty that day was the victim's mother. She was not calm. Her hands shook almost to the point where she bobbled her entire purse while searching through it. Tears rolled down her cheeks when the EMTs rushed in and removed her boy's hand from hers so that they could work on him. Still, she had the presence of mind to pull out a well-worn, thread-bound book that was quite familiar to me. It was an orchid-colored, soft-covered Leuchtturm 1917. The elastic was pulled down over the bottom left corner, holding a pen to the spine. It was a bullet journal. Grasping the last few pages, she shredded them away from the threaded spine and held them out to the EMT, asking her questions. She shook her head and sobbed, "I can't. I can't." "I have a pulse," the other EMT announced, while the guy in charge looked over the papers in astonishment. I sat down next to the mom and put my arm around her shoulders. This could easily be my child on the floor, I thought. Any of our children in this classroom. The mom told him shakily what was on the paper. His dosages and meds, his specialists and file numbers, phone numbers, allergies. She sucked in a breath. "Seizure log. There's a seizure log in there," she said. I squeezed her shoulders in support. "Mine has seizures too." She rattled off his birthday as they stabilized him for transportation. The EMT just shook his head and said to her, "Thank you. This is exactly what we need to help him. I have to call this in. And he pulled out his phone to do just that, rattling off vital information to whomever he was speaking with. She rode in the ambulance with her son. I watched as they banged the back doors shut and sped off, lights and sirens at full.
I hugged my son a little harder that night and then sat down and wrote a new spread in my own journal
with emergency information, medications, and dosages, a seizure log, phone numbers, file numbers, and an allergy list. Over the course of this evening, I went through an entire box of tissues before I called her cell. "He's okay," she told me. The doctor said that the info the EMTs sent ahead allowed them to act fast. "He's gonna be okay. He's okay," she repeated again, choked and hoarse, but I could hear the gratefulness in her voice. My son's friend has returned to school and carries a tiny oxygen cylinder in a tiny oxygen cylinder backpack. He's adorably sad about having to carry it, but he's alive, happy, and whole, which is all a parent can really ask for their children. I've also noticed that the other parents are now carrying notebooks of their own, presumably with the vitals necessary to help their kids in them. No one thinks that the next child in the next ambulance could be theirs, or that their elderly mother may have an emergency fall, or that after a car accident, one may not be able to remember all of the vital information needed to treat their family members safely in the hospital. But let's be honest here. We all know someone who has needed that information recently. We all have passed the accident on the highway. We all have had that momentary lapse in memory when asked something about our or our children's medical records. Write it down. Keep it with you. Be prepared to commit the ultimate bujo sin and rip it out in an emergency situation. You could save a life. Your own, your child's, your sister's, your father's. Being organized could be the difference between life and death. For a step-by-step guide to setting up your own bullet journal, please see the bonus PDF. Part 3, The Practice. The intersection between action and belief. Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. Alan Saunders. Now you have all the tools you need to use your bullet journal to get organized. It's an important step towards assuming responsibility for the precious little time and energy we're given. That said, organization can become a cleverly disguised form of distraction. You can spend hours crafting to-do lists without ever crossing off a single thing. You may disappear down the rabbit hole of cleaning your house while more important projects suffer. You can spend days, months, even years working in highly organized ways towards the wrong things, as I did with my paint-a-pig startup. The significance of what we're doing or how we're doing it pales in comparison to why we're doing it in the first place. Being busy doesn't necessarily mean we're being productive. Being busy can be likened to tumbling down an existential staircase. Stimulus, reaction, stimulus, reaction. This frenetic cycle of reactivity holds our attention hostage, limiting our ability to recognize opportunities for love, growth, and purpose. These are the things that add value to our lives, yet they're easily obscured by the rush of our busy lives. In order to become truly productive, we must first break this cycle. We need to wedge a space between the things that happen to us and the way that we react to them. In this space, we're granted an opportunity to examine our experience. Here we can learn what's in our control, what's meaningful, what's worth our attention, and why. It's how we begin to define who we are and what we believe in. Realizations like these are an important step forward, but the things we learn are simply thoughts. Like most thoughts, they fade over time, especially if they remain abstract and don't play an active role in our lives. Even the most fervent beliefs or helpful lessons can dissipate unless they're actively applied. What if you could put your beliefs into practice on a regular basis, test driving promising ideas and measuring their impact on your life when put into action? In part 3, you'll discover how the bullet journal method can act as a bridge between your beliefs and your actions. Each chapter will explore guiding philosophies from a variety of traditions and teach you how to put them into practice with the help of your notebook. Step by step, we'll close the distance between what we're doing and why by defining how to live an intentional life. one that's both productive and meaningful. Key concepts. You can't make time, you can only take time. Happiness is the byproduct of meaning. In order to be happy, you have to figure out what is meaningful. You figure out what is meaningful by putting in the time to cultivate your curiosity through setting goals. We accomplish our goals by breaking them down into small pieces because small questions and small solutions lead to big change over time. Productivity is about sustainable improvement. In order to achieve that, you have to look inward to reveal a way forward. Dedicate specific times for reflecting on the contents of your notebook. Prioritize what matters, discard what doesn't. Failure is guaranteed if you never begin. If you try and fail, you fail once. If you compromise and fail, you fail twice as hard because you know you didn't try. All you have to do is start. Better is greater than perfect. The only thing you can control is the way you respond. Focusing on things you can't control allows them to control you. Focus on what you can control. To be useful, you must become useful, especially to yourself. You can't improve the world around you if you can't improve the world within. Choose your friends wisely and be a friend to yourself. To start this process, study the good in your life. Achievement is empty without appreciation. If you can't appreciate your hard work, what's the point? It's important to find the music in the mundane. When you believe in what you're doing, pain is transformed by purpose. To see a visual guide of these key concepts, please see the included bonus PDF. Beginning. Many painters are afraid of the blank canvas, but the blank canvas is afraid of the painter who dares and who has broken the spell of "you can't" once and for all. Vincent van Gogh. To dare in life is to make yourself vulnerable to the possibility of failure. Most of us don't welcome failure, so instead we avoid taking risks. We compromise, taking cold comfort in the assumption that we've removed the possibility of failure, as we buckle up in the passenger seat and let life take the wheel. The truth is, there's no avoiding failure. While failure may never feel good, failure in a life of compromise can be twice as devastating. Let's say you didn't take that exciting job overseas because it was easier to stay where you were. Then, out of nowhere, you lose your comfortable job. Now you have to contend with the loss of two jobs, one of which could have been a transformational experience. You'll never know, but chances are you'll never stop wondering what might have been. Don't let fear dilute your life. Take, for example, Heather Cleary, who had struggled with performance anxiety since childhood. It hijacked her joy and her courage to try new things, take risks, and enjoy the things she loved most. There was no more obvious or bewildering example of this than her love of reading. After having kids, she found less and less time to indulge her simple joy of sitting down with a book. She realized that performance anxiety had spread into her reading habits. She felt as if she didn't read enough, widely enough, or the right kinds of books. The more self-conscious she became about her reading habits, the harder it was for her to make time to read. When she started bullet journaling, she was surprised at how motivating it was to X off boxes and how much she enjoyed the creativity of representing her daily life in beautiful ways in her notebook. Still, she hesitated to track her reading. "It'll only make me feel more anxious and aware that I'm not reading enough," she thought. When she finally created a Books Read collection, she was shocked to find the opposite was true. She read a lot. The issue wasn't that she lacked motivation. It was that she walled herself off from trying, lest she fail. Heather formed the habit of giving herself more credit for her efforts. The more she read, the more she felt at ease with herself. She began feeling the joy, excitement, and eagerness to read that she'd missed for years. Her bullet journal helped her to systematize her reading to overcome the barriers she'd felt. When we grant ourselves the opportunity to be rewarded by our courage, powerful things can happen. There has never been, nor will there ever be, another like you. Your singular perspective may patch some small hole in the vast tattered fabric of humanity. Uniqueness alone, however, does not make you valuable. If you don't do, if you don't dare, then you rob the world and yourself of the chance to contribute something meaningful. As the French film director Robert Bresson once said, make visible what, without you, might perhaps never have been seen. If you don't try something, it will assuredly never exist, not your version anyway. True, not all endeavors will be successful, but even our so-called failures can be valuable teachers. We must take it upon ourselves to grow. We grow by learning, and we learn by daring to take action. There will always be risk, because we can't control the outcome. This is the way of life, and it's unavoidable. What is avoidable, however, is being perpetually haunted by all the things that could have been if you had only dared. Begin by giving yourself permission to believe you're worth the risk. In practice. Sometimes the hardest part of getting started is knowing where to begin. Maybe you just don't know how to start tackling your goals, your projects, your tasks, or even getting organized. Maybe you're afraid that you'll get it wrong or that you'll disappoint yourself. If that's the case, an easy place to begin is to get into the habit of simply capturing your thoughts on paper. Start by taking notes on this audio program in your bullet journal. We will cover a lot of different ideas in part 3. I hope that some of the material will inspire new thoughts or provide information you find useful. Don't let it get away. Write it down. Create a bullet journal method collection in your notebook. As you read, rapid log whatever comes to mind using the bullets you learned about in part 2. Keep recording your thoughts as you make your way through the chapters, and you'll ease yourself into the system. Then figure out what you need next. Perhaps you'll add the index so you can find your notes later on to refresh your memory. Thoughts are the source of our goals, hopes, dreams, and ultimately, our actions. An easy place to start with any endeavor is simply taking your thoughts out of your head and organizing them on paper. In so doing, you've already crossed the starting line to realize that it's just another moment. The only difference is that now you're behind the steering wheel. Reflection. Know thyself. Socrates. What led you to listen to this audio program? What series of events led you here? Are you listening to this because it was a gift and you don't want to hurt the gifter's feelings? If that's the case, thank you for making it this far. Or was there something missing you were hoping to find here? If so, how would you define that missing piece? How has it affected your life? Chances are, these questions kicked up some dirt inside. It goes to show that no matter how simple an act may appear, it bears the legacy of countless bygone choices. One of my favorite sculptures is called The Thinker by Auguste Rodin. It's the one with the naked guy sitting on a block, resting his head on his hand, you know, thinking. Like a lot of Rodin's work, it feels unfinished. Some surfaces appear rough, others lack detail. The visibility of these millions of minute choices imparts immediacy and humanity to his work. It's as though we can see the artist himself thinking. Like a block of marble, our lives are finite. They start out rough and formless. Each choice we make places a chisel to the stone. Each action irreversibly chips away time. No action is so insignificant that it can't benefit from our attention. It's the lack of attention that's often responsible for the rubble of cringeworthy decisions weighing on our conscience. To be sure, making bad decisions, no matter how smart or wise you are, is an unavoidable part of being human. Life is also an unruly medium. It slips, it shatters, it shifts, it crushes. Sometimes we even find ourselves on the receiving end of the chisel. It leaves us all rough around the edges. The beautiful thing is, as long as you're still alive, there's always material left to work with. Like the thinker, your life doesn't have to be big, polished, or perfect to be beautiful. That said, we can do better. Many poor decisions are born in the vacuum of self-awareness. We get so caught up in the doing of things that we forget to ask why we're doing them in the first place. Asking why is the first small but deliberate step we can take in the search for meaning. The search for meaning often begins later than it needs to. Because it seems like such a monumental or esoteric undertaking, we tend to avoid this form of inquiry until it's forced on us by some shade of crisis or circumstance. Exploring our why from these dim places leaves us at a disadvantage. Our ability to see and think clearly is shrouded by our suffering. Soul searching doesn't need to be confined to the dark seasons of our lives. It can be a gentle part of our everyday. It all begins with becoming mindful of how we're investing our time and energy, the things our bullet journal is faithfully recording for our reference. You may be thinking analyzing my to-do list isn't going to answer life's big questions. Maybe. Or maybe it's because we're untrained in the art of asking these types of questions. To understand the big, intimidating whys, what is the meaning of life, why am I here, we start by asking the small whys. Why am I working on this project? Why is my partner irritating me? Why am I feeling stressed? In the bullet journal, we do this through the practice of reflection. Reflection is the nursery of intentionality. It grants us the protected mental environment we need to reclaim some much-needed perspective and begin to ask why. Through reflection, we cultivate the habit of checking in with ourselves to examine our progress, our responsibilities, our circumstances, and our state of mind. It helps us see if we're solving the right problems, answering the right questions. It's by questioning our experience that we begin to sort the wheat from the chaff, the why from the what. Don't worry, reflection is not an invitation to flagellate yourself for past failures. It's an opportunity to harvest the rich information embedded in your lived experience and use it to fertilize your future. Reflection helps identify what nourishes you so you can make better decisions as you see the next season of your life. Our lives are lived in seasons of more, seasons of less, seasons of triumph, seasons of loss. Each season sees our needs change. We live, learn, and adapt. So too must our definition of meaning. Things that grow in one season rot in another. If we blindly hold on to the past, we'll be forced to sustain ourselves with the expiring beliefs from seasons gone by. No wonder we're often left feeling unsatisfied, empty, starving for substance. In order to live fulfilling lives, we have to embrace the shifting nature of our experience by making our search for meaning an ongoing practice. This is why the bullet journal method has multiple reflection mechanisms built right in. This is where the method shifts from a system into a practice by helping us continually chip away what is unnecessary to reveal what is meaningful. In practice. Maybe you're thinking, Ryder, I want to be a more reflective person, but I never have time. I need to be in the right headspace to think deep thoughts. My thoughts are all over the place, and so am I. If you're bullet journaling, then you've already begun. By keeping different types of logs, you're not only organizing your responsibilities, you're also documenting your thoughts and actions. It's a passive form of reflection. All you need to do now is transition at your own pace from passive reflection to active reflection. Daily reflection. Throughout the day, you're using your daily log to simply capture your thoughts. Now it's just a matter of coming back to them. That's what daily reflection is designed for. It allows you to bookend each day with two dedicated times of active introspection. AM reflection, a time to plan. In the morning, or before you dive into your day, take a few moments to sit down with your bullet journal. If you're one of those people who wakes up with a mind swelling with thoughts, now's the time to relieve that pressure. Offload anything that's bubbled up overnight. Clear your mind to make room for the day ahead. For those of you breakfast zombies, the AM reflection helps get the gears turning. Next, review all the pages of the current month to remind yourself of any open tasks. This helps you focus and clarify your priorities and plan accordingly. You'll step into your day with confidence, clarity, and direction. PM reflection, a time to review. Where the AM reflection favors planning to gear up for your day, the PM reflection leans toward review to help you unwind. Before you go to bed, sit down with your bullet journal and scan what you've logged throughout the day. Mark completed tasks with an X. If a task is missing, write it down. Again, you're unburdening your mind. Once your journal is updated, bring your attention to each item individually. Here's where you begin to ask, why is this important? Why am I doing this? Why is this a priority? And so on. This will help you surface distractions. Strike out the tasks you've deemed to be irrelevant. Finally, take a moment to appreciate your progress. Acknowledge the simple ways in which you've won the day. The PM reflection can be a wonderful way to decompress before you sleep, relieving stress and anxiety through a sense of progress, preparedness, and purpose. Tip: you can use your daily reflection as your daily digital detox window. After your PM reflection, implement a screens-off policy that lasts until you completed your AM reflection the following morning. It's a simple way to get yourself into the habit of unplugging. Monthly and yearly reflection through migration. Technology is always moving us towards a more seamless existence. The less friction, the better. That's great when you're ordering pizza. You don't really need to understand all the miraculous tech that allows that hot, cheesy goodness to appear out of thin air at your doorstep. Convenience, however, often comes at the expense of understanding. The less time you spend examining things, the less you know about them. When it comes to understanding how you spend your life, it's important to slow down and take the time. Migration is designed to add the friction you need to slow down, step back, and consider the things you task yourself with. On the surface, it's an automatic filtering mechanism designed to leverage your limited patience. If something is not worth the few seconds it takes to rewrite it, then chances are that it's really not important. In addition, handwriting triggers our critical thinking, helping us to draw new connections between thoughts. As you migrate each item, you give yourself a chance to identify unconventional relationships or opportunities by holding each item under the microscope of your attention. For everything we say yes to, we're saying no to something else. Migration gives you an opportunity to recommit to what matters and let go of what does not. As Bruce Lee once said, "It is not daily increase, but daily decrease. Hack away the unessential." Consistency. I'm often asked how much time I spend on daily reflection. On average, I usually devote 5 to 15 minutes per session. It's not about how much time it takes. It's about being consistent. If you find yourself failing to check in for a reflection, reduce the amount of time you spend. Take as much or as little time as you need to make it part of your daily routine. The goal is getting into the habit of checking in with yourself, asking small whys. Over time, you get better at answering these questions. You're refining your beliefs, your values, your ability to spot your weaknesses and your strengths. Slowly but surely, you start to weed out distractions, which results in you steadily becoming more present and aware. Awareness. In his beautiful commencement speech, This is Water, at Kenyon College, author David Foster Wallace talked about the day-to-day and how, quote, "the so-called real world will not discourage you from operating on your own default settings, because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and the worship of self," end quote. He's talking about how, if we're not careful, we can start to go on autopilot, which can greatly diminish our experience of the world. During reflection, we get in the habit of switching off our autopilot by examining our experience. This form of inquiry requires us to ask questions and not take things at face value. It encourages us to think about ourselves and the world in a more considered way. Through consistently engaging with our experience, we become aware that even the dullest moment can have a hidden depth. As you cultivate your awareness, quote, It will actually be within your power to experience a crowded, hot, slow, consumer hell-type situation as not only meaningful, but sacred, on fire with the same force that lit the stars, compassion, love, the subsurface unity of all things. End quote. Summary. When you go to the optometrist, you're asked to read symbols off a chart through a large metal device with lenses known as a phoropter. As you read, the optometrist switches lenses, asking you which brings the symbols into focus. Is it better now? Click. How about now? Click. The purpose is to find an array of lenses that alters the way light hits our retinas, so we may see with greater clarity. When it comes to living a more intentional life, reflection functions as a phoropter. It's the mechanism that helps us improve our perception, but in order for it to work properly, we need to add the lenses. It's likely you already have some of your own, your values, and your beliefs. Reflection, however, is a rich and ancient practice. Each tradition offers its own lens through which we can correct our short-sightedness and sharpen our insight when we reflect. In the chapters that follow, I'll introduce you to the lenses I've found most useful. Let's explore these lenses designed to help us pull our life into greater focus. Meaning. Eyes see only light, ears hear only sound, but a listening heart perceives meaning. David Steindl-Rast. My favorite Twilight Zone episode is called A Nice Place to Visit. It follows the story of a Mr. Valentine, a scrappy burglar gunned down by the police during a robbery, who is guided into the afterlife by an affable Englishman in a crisp white suit. To Valentine's surprise, he's ushered into luxury, an opulent New York penthouse, closets stocked with bespoke suits, bars brimming with the finest liquor. He showboats around town in fancy cars and wins game after game at the casinos surrounded by smitten socialites. Money, power, sex appeal, everything he ever wanted, finally his. In time, though, the novelty fades. His joy withers to boredom. This perfect, longed-for existence reveals itself to be entirely unfulfilling. Valentine turns to his guide and says, "I don't think heaven is for me. I think I belong in the other place." Whereupon his guide wryly responds, "What makes you think this is heaven?" Success often feels surprisingly empty. That holds true not just for financial success, but for the kind of self-improvement we've always thought to be healthy and good. In the article, How I'm Overcoming My Obsession with Constant Self-Improvement, Leo Babauta, the creator of the blog Zen Habits, writes about how he ran an ultramarathon, participated in a Goruck challenge, a 10-hour obstacle course where you must wear a brick-filled backpack, and learned how to code, only to find that his life wasn't any better. The fantasy was never real, he writes. He's not alone in this realization. The world is more literate, well-fed, vaccinated, and technologically advanced than ever. A hunger for more, however, is prompting millennials to spend nearly twice as much per month on self-improvement as boomers, despite earning about half as much as their elder generation. Which raises another question. How do we reconcile this trend with the escalating rates of depression? American youths suffering from severe depression increased from 5.9% in 2012 to 8.2% in 2015. In the United States alone, anxiety disorders affect 40 million adults. That's 18.1% of the population. You might be thinking that getting fit and taking night classes are totally worthwhile goals. Maybe. But the impact of what you're doing is contingent on why you're doing it. The key is understanding the motivation underlying your hard work. Our efforts are always fueled by some promise. What exactly do you expect in exchange for your blood, sweat, and tears? What is the goal behind all of our goals? For most of us, it's to be happy. And therein lies the problem. Think back to the last goal you achieved. You pushed yourself hard, drawn to the potential and promise of a happier life. But when you finally crossed the finish line, what did you find? Did that raise, that new house, that car, that vacation make you feel the way you hoped it would? Chances are the answer is no, or not for long anyway. Why is that? We can begin to untangle this conundrum by accepting a simple truth. None of us can know with any true certainty what will make us happy. In fact, it turns out that we're pretty lousy at guessing how something will make us feel, thanks to a phenomenon known as impact bias. Quote, the tendency for people to overestimate the length or the intensity of future feeling states, unquote. In essence, we chronically underestimate our ability to adapt. As we race towards our goals, we learn new things, and our circumstances change. By the time we arrive at the finish line, we're simply different people. The best we can do is guess what will make us happy. So we place blind bets, gambling away our money, our time, and our sanity in the pursuit of happiness. It seems the harder we try to be happy, the more elusive happiness becomes. As comedian Tim Minchin once quipped, happiness is like an orgasm. If you think about it too much, it will go away. Speaking of which, our built-in drive for pleasure is another critical factor in understanding the enigmatic nature of happiness. We're built to adapt to heat, to cold, to hardship, and this is partially a result of our ability to experience pleasure. Pleasure allowed us to quickly discern good from bad, harmful from helpful. We like things that feel good, and we'll go out of our way for more of the good stuff, like shelter, sustenance, water. In the bad old days, when we spent most of our time, you know, trying not to die, pleasure was limited and practical. Nowadays it's a commodity, marketed as a substitute for happiness, and it's on demand. Thanks to our ability to rapidly adapt, even the most pleasurable experience or purchase quickly becomes the boring new normal. Soon we're itching for another quick fix of pleasure. No longer satisfied with what we already have, we treat our withdrawal pains by incrementally upping the dosage. More shoes, more booze, more sex, more food, more likes, just more. This phenomenon is known as hedonic adaptation. Exploiting what Sean Parker, founding member of Facebook, called this vulnerability in human psychology, is the bread and butter of our economy. Notice how much advertising focuses not on good, but on more, better, faster, fresher, stronger, lighter. Good is enough, but better is a promise of happiness that's just another transaction away. What can be bought can be owned. That is the social contract. You buy shoes at the shoe store, clothes at the clothing store, cars at the dealership, and so on. Notice that there is no happiness store. It's not because it can't be bought. It's because happiness can't be owned. Happiness, like sadness, comes and goes. It's an emotion, and like all emotions, it's blessedly temporary. Imagine a world in which our emotions calcified, forcing us to entertain our demons indefinitely. Or Valentine's heaven/hell, where things are so perfect, so lacking in contrast, that everything ultimately feels meaningless. It would poison us. In fact, we often define the inability to transition between emotional states as mental illness. Seen in this light, seeking some mythical state of perpetual happiness not only collides with reality, but seems undesirable. So, are all our goals, all our striving ultimately pointless? Not in the least. It means that happiness itself can't be the goal. Clearly, happiness is important. So the question becomes, how do we lure it into our lives? When you look up the term, you'll find more than a dozen synonyms demonstrating how complex and nuanced the experience can be, but none volunteers a way for us to be happy. This is the domain of philosophy, which, despite its stuffy reputation, was conceived to help us live better lives. One such philosophy is Greek eudaimonism, quote, a moral philosophy that defines right action as that which leads to the well-being of the individual, unquote. This idea of contented well-being as simply a byproduct of personal industry is a recurring theme in a variety of philosophical traditions around the world. In other words, happiness is the result of our actions directed towards other goals. If happiness is the result of our actions, then we need to stop asking ourselves how to be happy. Rather, we need to be asking ourselves how to be. The people of Okinawa, Japan, for example, are among the happiest and long-lived populations, with the world's highest ratios of centenarians at approximately 50 per 100,000. When asked what their secret to happiness was, a common answer was ikigai. Your ikigai is at the intersection of what you are good at and what you love doing, says author Hector Garcia. He writes, just as humans have lusted after objects and money since the dawn of time, other humans have felt dissatisfaction at the relentless pursuit of money and fame and have instead focused on something bigger than their own material wealth. This has over the years been described using many different words and practices, but always hearkening back to the central core of meaningfulness in life. Maybe we have it all backward. It seems that in our pursuit of happiness, we're taking our focus off of what could be meaningful. But it's in the pursuit of what is meaningful that happiness seems most likely to appear. As Viktor Frankl put it, happiness cannot be pursued. It can only ensue. The question becomes, what is meaningful? Many of us aren't sure, and that's okay. It's a profoundly complicated question that's been giving us headaches as long as we've had the heads to think about it. Academic definitions are vague by necessity to encompass the many subjective views of what's meaningful. We've experienced firsthand how our subjective definition of what is meaningful changes over time. Do you still treasure the same things as your 12-year-old self? Probably not. What is clear is that there is no single meaning to life. There are many. From service to faith to family to contribution, people are happy to volunteer all sorts of avenues towards meaning. Yes, they're all worthy, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you will find them fulfilling. I've met plenty of disillusioned volunteers, social workers, teachers, doctors, and even parents. They know that what they're doing is objectively meaningful, yet they just don't feel it. What does feeling have to do with meaning? Arguably, everything. There is no intellectualizing what resonates with you, and that's why it's so hard to define. When it reveals itself, you feel it. The Greeks had a term for this, phanesthai, which has been roughly translated at different times to showing itself, that which reveals itself, shining forth, and to appear. Your senses will witness what shines forth, that which holds the promise of meaning. If we live passive lives, ones where we don't pursue what shines forth, we remain in the dark, largely ignorant as to our place in the world. In this state, our efforts, no matter how well-intentioned or noble, will often feel meaningless because they seem to serve no purpose. We try and fail to fill that void with things, which does little more than to weigh us down even further. That's why it's vital to seek out what shines forth for you. How do we uncover what shines forth? Just as we have a built-in mechanism for seeing, we also have a built-in mechanism for sensing the luminous things that call to us, our curiosity. Our curiosity is the exciting electricity we feel in the presence of potential. It sparks our imagination and wonder, drawing us out of ourselves and into the world. It's a magnetism that often supersedes reason, greed, personal gain, and even happiness. You've already experienced this in some form, be it attraction to a person, fascination with a topic, or the thrill of working on something you enjoy. Your curiosity can also be drawn towards things that you haven't experienced yet. Maybe it's the idea of raising a family, starting a company, making an album, or addressing a particular problem in the world. Whatever they may be, these are the things that your heart has identified as potentially meaningful. The question is, have you ever granted yourself a moment to define what exactly these things are? Let's zoom way out. Before you join that gym, enroll in those classes, buy that TV, or even set goals, it helps to have some basic big picture awareness that guides your actions. You need to take the time to articulate your vision for what it means to live a meaningful life based on your felt experience. If you don't orient yourself this way, you can lose yourself in the other place, far removed from the things you care about. So let's start by figuring out what kind of life you want to lead, beginning with the following exercises. In practice. A tale of two lives. This thought experiment was inspired by the poem The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Imagine you are a traveler who arrives at a fork in the road. On one side is the well-worn path. On the other, you find the path less traveled. The well-worn path. This path leads you towards the familiar. It favors comfort over risk. It is a continuation of your current life. You simply move along in whatever pursuits are comfortable for you, putting little effort into changing your lesser qualities or striving for improvement. At the end of this life, what will you have accomplished, personally and professionally? What are the consequences of this life? The path less traveled. This path leads you into the unfamiliar. It's a life that favors risk over comfort. You dare to pursue the things that interest you and actively work to improve yourself. At the end of this life, what will you have accomplished, personally and professionally? What are the consequences of this life? Now, bear with me. For each path, take 15 minutes or more to write your obituary based on having taken that path. Create a Two Lives collection and add it to your index. Start with one spread for one path. Set up the second spread only when you've completed the first. Fill as many pages as you need. Dig deep. Be honest. This is for your eyes only. What do you see as you look far down each path? Postmortem. 1. Read through both obituaries. On the next page in your notebook, write yourself a letter. What realizations, emotions, questions, positives, or negatives came up during the exercise? What surprised you? What saddened or scared you? What excited you? The point is to capture how you feel about seeing your whole life flash before your eyes. Phrase it in a way to remind your future self, the one who will be reading this later, what shifted, because something definitely will. Remind yourself what you're trying to get away from and where you want to go. 2. Select the life you liked best and identify and circle the accomplishments that you're most proud of. Once you're done, migrate these items into a goals collection. Just like that, you've taken the first step towards realizing a more meaningful life on your own terms. Let's keep going. Goals. We can do no great things, only small things with great love. Mother Teresa. Curiosity points the needle of our inner compass toward the hopeful magnetism of possibility and meaning. It's the force that compels us to venture out of our comfort zone into unfamiliar territory filled with uncertainty and risks. The question becomes, how do we best harness our curiosity while reducing the risk of failure? We set goals. When set with intention, goals can provide structure, direction, focus, and purpose. Goals give us the opportunity to define what we want. When not set with intention, goals can be knee-jerk reactions to something ugly or painful in our lives. If you're feeling overweight, for example, dedicating yourself to running a marathon that's a few months away is a reactionary goal, and likely a counterproductive one. Your chances of achieving that goal are slim, but the chances of hurting or disappointing yourself are high. When setting reactionary goals, you're likely to find yourself right back where you started. High risk, low reward. Appropriating other people's goals is another common pitfall. Make $1 million, for example, is a kind of goal we hear bandied about, but it's not a meaningful one. Why? Because it serves no purpose. It's empty calories. Your goals need real substance in order to be sustainable. You need to understand exactly why you need $1 million. Your goals should be inspired by your felt experience. Surely you have sources of real passion in your life, whether the positive impetus of what brings you joy or painful lessons from the school of hard knocks. Put them to work. Both are powerful wells from which you can draw meaningful goals. With that in mind, let's try again to set that big money goal. I want to make enough money to pay off my student loans, buy a two-bedroom house for my parents to retire in, and cover my kids' education. This goal, by contrast, though still ambitious, has meaningful parameters. You know exactly how it would impact your life for the better. This is critical, because big goals take time and sustained effort to complete. Of all the challenges you'll face along the way, endurance often proves to be the most cunning and lethal adversary. Big goals, therefore, must be fueled by an authentic need that will help you weather the days, months, or even years it takes to fulfill them. That need must be strong enough to fortify you against the siren songs of distraction, excuses, and doubt that will beckon you toward the rocks. Angela Lee Duckworth, PhD, author of Grit, found that perseverance and passion for long-term goals indicated success better than any other predictor. For some of us, perseverance and passion conjure images of no-pain-no-gain athletes scoring game-winning points or sticking landings on fractured limbs, eccentric creatives sacrificing all for art as they shiver in icy garrets, or monks spending decades meditating in silence. But passion and perseverance, like all emotional qualities, live on a spectrum. In an all-or-nothing world, we tend to forget the power of something. The mightiest tree sprouts from a vulnerable seed. The seed of passion is curiosity. The seed of perseverance is patience. By designing your goals strategically, you can begin to cultivate your opportunities by seeding both your patience and curiosity. In practice, create a goals collection. Our ambitions often suffer from being little more than vague notions or abstract daydreams swimming around in our heads. One day I'll... Let's start by capturing our ideas on paper so we can transform them into actionable goals. If you haven't done so already, create a goals collection in your bullet journal on the next blank spread. Big or small, just write them down here so you have them clearly contained in one reusable place. In doing so, you've already taken the first important step to realizing them. This collection serves as a menu of sorts, listing your potential futures. It can keep you focused and motivated, but even the greatest menu is useless if you don't order. The next step is to start nudging yourself toward action. Otherwise, it's easy to hoard goals, waiting for just the right moment to get started. That moment will never come. We have to create our own opportunities because life doesn't wait. The 5-4-3-2-1 exercise. A great way to get motivated is by realizing just how limited your time really is. The 5-4-3-2-1 exercise is designed to help you contextualize your goals in terms of time. It will quantify your objectives by breaking them down over the short, mid, and long term. If you're struggling to tackle your goals, give this a try. First, turn to your next blank spread. The topic for this new collection will be 5-4-3-2-1. Divide the spread into 5 rows on each page. The left page will be for your personal goals, and the right page will be for your professional goals. The top cell will store the goals you want to accomplish in 5 years. In the next cell, you'll have goals you want to achieve in 4 months. The next cell will be for goals to achieve in 3 weeks. The next cell will be for goals to attain in 2 days. And in the final cell will be for the goals you intend to accomplish in the next 1 hour. Now turn back to your goals collection and migrate your goals into their appropriate cells. It doesn't have to line up exactly, but the idea is to start the process of defining the amount of time and energy, perseverance and passion your goals require, both individually and as a whole. It will provide some much-needed context. To see what the 5-4-3-2-1 collection looks like, please refer to the bonus PDF. Prioritize your goals. Once you've plotted out your goals, consider them individually. Are they worth the amount of time you think they will take? If not, cross them off. Prioritize the remaining items. Which ones really resonate with your experience? Which ones shine forth brighter than the others? Mark them with the priority signifier. If you're implementing the 5-4-3-2-1 exercise, you may only prioritize one goal in each cell. Personal and professional pages should be graded separately, leaving you with 10 priorities total. Add your 4 short-term goals, those in the hour and day cells, to your daily log, and set them as priorities with the priority signifier. Knock them out first to build the momentum you need to tackle your bigger goals. That takes care of 4 of your 10 goals. The remaining goals all get their own separate collection, for example, travel to Hawaii, or gain fluency in another language. If you hesitate to create 6 new collections, 3 personal, 3 professional, perhaps it's an indicator that some of your goals aren't as important as you thought. That's okay. Strike them out. It's not about how many goals you have. It's about working on what matters. Focus on your priorities. Once your collections are set up, take a moment to promise yourself not to revisit your goals or 5-4-3-2-1 collections until the ones you've picked are either complete or have become irrelevant. If you're an ambitious person, a list of potential projects can be very distracting. The thought of beginning something new can be alluring, especially if what you're currently working on is dragging out. Resist. Living intentionally is about focusing on what's most important now. Keep this in mind when picking your goals. What do you want to put into your life now? And more importantly, why? We want to be working on the fewest number of things possible. What? Wouldn't it be more effective to be multitasking? No. We want to keep multitasking to an absolute minimum. Why? Studies suggest that only around 2% of the population is psychologically able to multitask. The rest of us aren't multitasking. We're simply juggling. We're not working on things simultaneously. We're actually microtasking, rapidly switching between tasks, struggling not to drop the balls. When you leave a task unfinished and move quickly on to something else, you leave part of your attention behind you, stuck to that project you were just working on. University of Minnesota professor Sophie Leroy, PhD, calls this attention residue. She writes that people need to stop thinking about one task in order to fully transition their attention and perform well on another. Yet results indicate it's difficult for people to transition their attention away from an unfinished task, and their subsequent task performance suffers. In other words, the more thinly you slice your attention and time, the less focused you become. The less focused you become, the less progress you make. This is why you may feel like you're not getting a lot done even though you're super busy. Attend to your core priorities. Use them as a barrier to prevent other distractions from leaking in. Go through them systematically, focusing as much attention as possible on one thing at a time. Give your goals the opportunity they deserve to reveal their lessons by focusing on the process. It's arguably the process, rather than the goals themselves, that will prove to be most valuable. The process accounts for the majority of the experience and therefore provides the bulk of the information that will help you grow. Break down your goals into sprints. When I was very young, all I wanted to do in life was be a stop-motion animator. I grew up endlessly rewatching movies inspired by the Arabian Nights and Greek myths, featuring fantastic creatures designed by Ray Harryhausen. That, I told myself, was what I wanted to do. No question. No doubt. Until I did it. I eventually shot a short stop-motion piece with a friend. It turned out reasonably well for a movie with the whopping budget of frozen pizza and some clay. I learned a lot working on that project, but most importantly, I learned that pursuing this career would leave me one fry short of a happy meal. Sure, the realization was a bit heartbreaking, but it was also a relief. It freed me to explore other things. Now I never look back and wonder what might have been. Not all things we're into are meant to be our occupation. That in itself is a valuable lesson to learn, especially when you're young. It's important to figure out what role the things that interest you play in your life. Not every hobby or curiosity is a calling, but some are. We figure that out by safely trying them on for size for a short period of time. before making a major commitment. Note that I tried out stop-motion animation in a small way, on a short-term project, before committing myself to a major goal like applying to an animation program at a film school. Breaking down long-term goals into smaller, self-contained goals